That was hardly a battle. Then, during that delightful cocktail party where you chased us down and tried to set fire to my hair.
We cannot kill you, Boy King. For one thing, we know the unrest it would cause your country, and we do not wish to see more people die if it is not necessary. Besides, even in your death, the power might well survive. No, the Darkling's curse must be burned out of you.
Obispaya, said Nikolai. The burning thorn. Elisaveta nodded.
Then you know the old ritual.
It is true then, cried Yori. All of it. This is the site of the thornwood where the first priest guard came.
Congratulations, Yori, Nikolai said. Looks like you do get to put me on a pyre.
Pyre?
Asked Grigory.
No pyre, said Elisaveta. The thornwood is older than all of us, older than the first magic. It is the wood from which the first altars were made, and from which the walls of the little palace were constructed. I can raise it from the roots that survive beneath the fold to begin the ritual.
But then it will be up to you to summon the monster from inside and slay it.
You created those miracles, said Zoya. The bridge, the roses, the earthquake, the bleeding statues, the black disc, all of them to bring us here.
The Age of Saints, Yuri declared, just as he promised.
Elisaveta's vine curled a bit more tightly around the monk's shoulders.
Our power can still reach beyond the limits of the fold, but only in the places where we are still worshipped.
A gracious power doesn't rely on faith, Zoya said angrily.
Are you so sure, little witch?
Asked Juris. Zoya looked directly at him, her gaze unflinching, and Nikolai knew she was planning 1,000 punishments for the dragon. He felt a rush of relief at the promise of retribution in her eyes. But he couldn't afford to get caught up in the mechanics of Grisha power. You say you want me to summon the monster, but the thing inside me doesn't follow orders.
Then you must teach it to, said Juris.
Elisaveta clapped her hands, and roses bloomed over her wrists, enveloping her fingers.
Once the thorns rise, they will pierce your body. If you don't vanquish the shadow inside you, they will burn you from the inside out.
Quite a bit like Sankt Felix of the apple boughs, after all. Suddenly the pyre didn't sound so bad.
Thank goodness I'm not ticklish.
What are the chances he'll survive? Zoya asked.
Roses flowered over Elisaveta's shoulders.
As Joris said, we have no wish to destabilize Ravka.
That isn't an answer.
It is perilous, Elisaveta conceded. There are means we can use to prepare you for the trial.
But I cannot promise you will emerge unscathed.
Or that you will emerge at all, said Joris.
Elisaveta sighed. Is it necessary to cast this in the least favorable light?
It's best they know.
Nikolai shifted on the stone chair. It had not been made for comfort.
So, after you skewer and roast me, and I wrestle with my actual demons, what happens?
The Darkling's power will be eradicated once and for all. The boundaries of the Unsea will break.
Life will return to the fold, and we will be free.
Free to do what exactly? Zoya asked. It was the right question. She might be mourning her lost amplifier, but she was always a general, and perhaps Nikolai was too desperate for a cure to think like a king. Maybe power of the kind they'd just witnessed should be contained.
Don't you know, little witch, said Joris. Great power always has a price.
Elisaveta gave a single nod of her head.
When we leave the bounds of the fold, we'll be mortal once more.
Mortal? Zoya asked.
Otkazatsia, you would say? Without Grisha power,
humans who will live brief lives and die permanent deaths.
Zoya's eyes narrowed.
Why would you give up such power?
Do not think it is an easy choice, said Elisaveta, some bitterness in her voice. We have spent hundreds of years in debate over it, but we cannot go on in such a way. This is what the universe demands for freedom from this half-life.
One eternity is enough, said Juris. I want to walk the world once more, return to the shores of my homeland, maybe fall in love again. I want to swim in the sea and lie in the sun. I want to age and die and pass into realms I have never explored.
You should understand, said Grigori. It is not just your life at risk, but your country as well. If we fail, if you cannot endure the ritual, we might create another tear in the world and cause this blighted place to overspill its shores.
But that may happen anyway, said Elisaveta. Everything is connected, tied to the making at the heart of the world. As the power within you grows stronger, there's no way to tell what kind of chain reaction it might trigger.
You will want to discuss it, said Grigori. But make your choices quickly. Merzost is unpredictable, and every day the monster inside you takes firmer hold.
There is nothing to discuss, Nikolai said. They had their answers, and time was short.
When do we begin?
Chapter 18. Nina. That night, Nina stayed awake as Leonie's breathing turned deep and even. Sleep tugged at her, but she plaited her hair in the dark and waited, hoping to hear sounds of activity drift through the narrow window above her bed. Sure enough, just after midnight, she heard low voices and a cart being loaded. Nina stood on tiptoe and saw lanterns lit in the laundry, and the spring maidens carrying sacks of what she assumed was clothing, wrapped in paper and string. Nina hurried to the convent dining hall, a place with a strict schedule that she knew Hannah could always count upon to be empty at specific times. If an unhappy novitiate was looking for a safe spot to stash clothing, this would be an obvious place for it. She got on her knees and made her way around the perimeter of the hall, lightly rapping her knuckles against the slate tiles of the floor. She'd nearly given up hope when her knock returned an odd echoing thunk. Hollow. She wedged her fingers under the tile and pulled it up. Boots, military-issue trousers, two hats, a gun belt, and, thank the saints, a long pale blue pinafore and white blouse. Nina yanked them over her clothes, pinned her braids into a messy crown, and slipped into the kitchens, where a long search revealed the cook's key beneath a flour tin. By the time she'd unlocked the kitchen door and made it out to the yard, the spring maidens were shutting the doors to the wagon and on their way. Nina knew where they were headed, so she didn't bother with the road, cutting through the trees and taking a more direct route to the main entrance of the old fort instead. She also knew she was being reckless. She should have included Adric and Leonie in her plans. She should have waited to perform more reconnaissance. But here was the reality. They couldn't stay in Gothala much longer without drawing suspicion. The women of the well could lose their access to the fort at any time. And if Nina was honest with herself, she needed to act. She needed to know why those whispers had brought her to this place, and what had happened on that hill. The dead hadn't spoken to Adric or Leonie. They had called to Nina, and she intended to answer. She set a fast pace, picking her way through the trees, checking her direction against the lights of the factory in the distance. Despite the sadness and anger she'd carried with her to Fjerda, she could admit that she liked traveling in this country. She liked seeing the ordinary business of Fjerdan lives, remembering that they were people and not monsters, that most of them longed for prosperity and peace, a good meal, a warm bed to sleep in at night. But she also knew the prejudices so many of them carried, that they still believed Grisha deserved to be burned on a pyre. And she could never forget what the Fjerdan government was capable of, the suffering she'd endured at the hands of the Druskella. who had starved her in the hold of a ship. The nightmare of the Grisha cells at the Ice Court, where Jarl Broom had tried to turn her kind into weapons against themselves. Nina reached the rocks overlooking the main entrance in time to see the convent cart arrive and the gates open. She stumbled down the slope to the road, sliding on her heels and nearly losing her balance completely. The shape of the body Jenya had given her still felt strange, and she'd never had a talent for stealth. Moving through the shadows of the trees that lined the road, she saw the last of the spring maidens pass through the doors, burdened with their sacks of clothing. Only then did she step onto the road and scurry up to the doors, breathless.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "I fell behind."
"That's your problem," said the guard. "Do you know how heavy these doors are? You can wait out here for your sisters."
But, you don't understand. I had to use the necessary," Nina whispered in tones of great agony.
"The what?"
"I had to relieve myself."
The guard looked instantly distressed. Bless the Fjärdins and their peculiar prudishness.
"I had to urinate."
Nina lingered on the word.
"In the trees."
That's no concern of mine," he sputtered.
Nina forced tears to her eyes.
"But I had to go," she wailed. "And they're going to be so mad.
"Oh, in Jell's good name, don't cry."
"I'm so sorry," Nina sobbed. "I just don't want to get yelled at again."
In, said the guard hurriedly, unlocking the bolts and dragging the door open to usher her inside. "Just stop that."
Thank you,
Nina said, bowing and sniveling until the door shut behind her. She wiped her nose and took a good look around. The factory was quiet, already closed for the night. Somewhere she knew men would be playing cards or settling into sleep. Others would be keeping watch. Nina hurried through the entryway that led to a vast central chamber full of heavy machinery, hulking and silent in the watery moonlight from the windows. The next room revealed massive vats, but it was impossible to tell what they might contain. She laid her hand against the side of one of them. Still warm. Were they smelting metals here? Mixing dyes? The next room held the answer. Tidy, endless stacks of stubby bullet-shaped cylinders the size of pumpkins, row after row of ammunition for tanks. Were they really just making munitions up here? Were the poisons in the river some corrosive byproduct from the assembly lines? But if so, why had the wolf's bite sent a bolt of lightning through her blood? It didn't add up. Nina wasn't sure where to go next. The factory felt much larger now that she was inside it. She wished she had Inej's gift for spy work or Kaz's gift for scheming, but she only seemed to have Jasper's gift for bad decisions. She knew the eastern wing was unoccupied and in disrepair, so the Spring Maidens had probably headed toward the western wing, the domestic heart of the fort, where the soldiers would eat, be billeted, and train when they were not operating the factory. If she were Inej, she could climb into the eaves and probably glean some excellent intelligence. But she was not a tiny, soundless shadow with a gift for knife work. It wasn't too late to go back. She had confirmed this was a munitions factory, a military target for Ravka's bombers if war came. But the whispers had not ceased their rustling, and they did not want her to leave. She closed her eyes and listened, letting them guide her footsteps to the right, into the dark quiet of the abandoned eastern wing. Every part of her protested that she was wasting her time as she made her way down the corridor. This wing of the factory was deserted. She'd seen no lanterns lit in the windows at dusk, and the roof of the far corner was slumped in, where it had given way to snow or time and never been repaired. But the voices drew her on. "Closer," they whispered, young voices and old. They had a different quality now, clearer, louder, the memory of their pain vibrating through every word. The dark was so complete she had to edge along the walls, fingers trailing over uneven brick, hoping she wouldn't stumble into some neglected piece of machinery and land on her rump. She thought of that ruined roof. Had there been some kind of accident at the factory that had led to the wing being abandoned? Were those the graves she'd sensed? Had women worked the line here and been buried on the mountain? If so, she'd find nothing but old misery in this place. Then she heard it. A high, thin wail that raised the hair on her arms. For a moment, she wasn't sure if the sound was in her head or had come from somewhere deeper in the eastern wing. She was too well acquainted with the dead to believe in ghosts. Does it matter where it's coming from? She thought, heart racing. What would an infant be doing in the ruined wing of an old factory? She forced herself to continue moving along the wall, listening, ignoring the ragged sound of her own breathing. At last, she saw a dim slice of light beneath a door up ahead. She paused. If there were soldiers on the other side of the door, she had no way to justify her presence there. She was too far from the main body of the building to pretend she'd simply gotten lost. She'd heard a noise behind her and saw the swaying circle of a lantern approaching. Nina pressed herself against the wall, expecting to see a uniformed soldier. Instead, the lamplight caught the profile of a woman dressed in a spring maiden's pinafore, braids piled atop her head. What was she doing so far from the others? As the spring maiden pushed through the door, Nina glimpsed another dark hallway, the gloom of it heavy between lanterns set at distant intervals. Nina gathered her courage and trailed the spring maiden inside. She followed as closely as she dared, her heart thumping hard in her chest as sounds began to float back to her from the darkness ahead. The low murmurs of women's voices, someone singing what sounded like a lullaby. And then a sweet, high-pitched sound of delight. A baby laughing. The whispers in Nina's head rose again, less angry than longing. "Hush now," they said. "Hush." The spring maiden passed through an archway into a dormitory. Nina sank into the shadows by the arch, not quite believing what she saw before her. Women and girls lay in narrow beds as the spring maidens moved among them. Beyond them, Nina glimpsed a row of bassinets. The room was otherwise bare, the dusty ruin of the factory wing cleared of equipment. The windows had been papered over in black to prevent any lamplight from leaking outside and raising questions. A girl who couldn't be more than 16 was being walked up and down the length of the corridor by a spring maiden. Her feet were bare and she wore a light gray gown that stretched over her jutting belly. "I can't," she moaned. She looked unspeakably frail, the thrust of her stomach at odds with the sharp knobs and angles of her bones. "You can," said the spring maiden, her voice firm as she led the girl by her elbow. "She needs to eat," said another of the women from the convent. "Skipped her breakfast." The spring maiden tisked. "You know you aren't to do that."
"I'm not hungry,"
panted the girl between heavy breaths. "We can either walk to help the baby come, or I can sit you down for some semla. The sugar will give you energy during the birth." The girl began to cry.
"I don't need sugar. You know what I need."
A tremor passed through Nina as understanding came. She recognized that desperation, that deep hunger that sank its teeth into you until all you were was wanting. She knew the need that turned everything you'd cared for, friends, food, love, to ash, until all you could remember of yourself was the desire for the drug. The wasted body, the dark hollows beneath her eyes. This girl was addicted to Parem. And that meant she must be Grisha. Nina peered down the row of beds at the women and girls. The youngest looked to be about 15. The oldest might have been in her 30s, but the ravages of the drug made it hard to tell. Some cradled small bumps beneath their thin blankets, others hunched over high, protruding stomachs. A few might not have been pregnant, or might not have been showing yet. Nina felt her body tremble, heard the thunder of her heartbeat in her ears. What was this place? Who were these women? "Help us." Could these be the voices she had heard? But none of the women were looking at Nina. It was the dead who had summoned her. Justice. The door behind Nina opened again, and as one, the patients in their beds turned their heads like flowers seeking the sun.
"She's here," cried one of them, as the well mother swept in.
She was pushing a cart. The women began to rise from their beds, but the well mother gave a short, sharp, "Be still." They sank back obediently against their pillows.
"There will be no rushing or shoving. You will get your injection when we come to you."
Nina eyed the rows of syringes on the cart and the ruddy liquid inside them. She wasn't even sure if it was Perim. But she felt the pull of the drug, could swear she smelled it on the air. A year ago, she would have clawed her way to those syringes without a second thought for revealing herself. She'd fought hard to break free from the addiction and had learned that using her new power helped. Now she focused on that power, on the current of that cold and silent river. She needed all the sense and calm she could summon because none of what she was seeing made sense. Grisha and the influence of Parem were beyond powerful. They could accomplish things that were otherwise unimaginable, even with the most extraordinary amplifier. Jarl Broom had attempted to experiment on Grisha with the drug in the hope of turning them into weapons to be used against Hrothgar. But always under carefully controlled conditions. His Grisha captives had been confined to specially built cells that prohibited them from using their power. And the Parem had been mixed with a sedative to try to make the prisoners more compliant. These women weren't even in restraints. The well mother moved down the line, handing syringes to the sisters, who injected the orange concoction into waiting arms. Nina heard a few sobs, a low, contented groan, a grumbled, "She always starts on that end. It isn't fair." The pregnant girl being walked along the aisle said,
"Please, just a little.
Not so soon before the baby comes. It could put you both at risk." The girl began to cry.
"But you never give it to the mothers after the babies come."
"Then you'll just have to get pregnant again, won't you?" The girl cried harder, and Nina didn't know if it was hunger for the drug or dread at what the Spring Maiden was suggesting that made the girl cover her face and weep. The women fell back in their beds, fingers flexing at their sides. The fire in the lanterns leapt. A gust of wind shifted a stack of bedsheets. Mist gathered over one girl's bed. She must be a tide maker. But they were all docile, gave not a single sign of defiance. Grisha on Perem didn't behave this way. It was a stimulant. Had the drug been combined with another substance? Was this what had poisoned the wolves? If Nina somehow managed to steal a syringe, would Leoni be able to discern what new atrocity the Fjerdans had concocted? And how had the girls survived long enough on the drug to bear children? Maybe multiple children? A baby began to cry in one of the tiny cribs. A Spring Maiden snatched a bottle from the bottom of the cart and picked up the infant, quieting it.
"There you go, sweetheart," she crooned.
Nina pushed back against the wall, afraid her legs might give way. This could not be. But if the mothers were ingesting Perim, then the babies would be too. They would be born addicted to the stuff. Perfect Grisha slaves. Nina shuddered. Was this Broom's work? Someone else's? Were there other bases that had been given over to these experiments? Why did I think these nightmares stopped at the ice court? How could I have been so naive? Her gaze fell on a woman lying in a daze, face nearly as pale as her pillow. A young girl lay in the bed next to her. Nina gripped the wall to steady herself. She recognized them. The mother and daughter from the Elling docks. Berger had sent them here. Nina wished she'd killed him more slowly. Was this what had become of the Grisha women who hadn't made it to the safe house in Elling? Were they in this room right now?
"Girls go missing from Kayarut."
Not just any girls. Grisha. A bell sounded somewhere in the factory. The well mother clapped her hands, and several of the Spring Maidens gathered to follow her.
"Have a good night, Marit," she said to one of the uniformed women as she left. "We'll have a shift in to relieve you tomorrow night."
Nina slipped in behind them as they left the dormitory. She kept to the gloom, trying to steady herself and think of the task ahead. Getting out of the factory. But her mind felt fractured and wild, crowded with the images of that room.
Help us, the voices of the dead. The pain of the living.
Ahead, she could see the spring maidens approaching the guards at the main door.
Did your straggler find you?
She heard one of the guards ask the well mother.
What straggler?
I don't know. Braids, pinafore? Look the same as the rest of you.
What are you talking about? We're all very tired and...
Line up for a head count.
Is that strictly necessary?
Line up.
Nina did not wait to hear the rest. She set off at a sprint, back down the hall toward the eastern wing, trying to keep her footsteps light. The main entrance wasn't an option anymore. If the guards discovered an extra spring maiden had... A bell began to sound, different from the last, high and shrill. An alarm. Lights came on all around her, the sudden glare blinding. She wasn't going to make it back through the dormitory to the eastern gate. Nina slid behind a dusty hunk of machinery as two guards stormed past, guns at the ready. She looked up. Several of the windows here were broken, but how to reach them? And what was on the other side? No time to debate the issue. By now, the guards and the well mother knew that a rogue spring maiden or someone dressed in a convent pinafore had infiltrated the factory. Nina had to get down the mountain and back to the convent before anyone found her bed empty. She scrambled atop the old piece of equipment and reached for the window ledge, struggling to haul herself up. She managed to wedge her foot between two bricks and shove her body onto the stone ledge. Through the broken glass, she could see the twinkling lights of the town in the distance, patches of snow on the forest floor below. She heard footsteps and saw another squad of armed soldiers charging through the eastern wing on heavy boots.
Lock down the perimeter, one was saying. We'll search in a grid and work our way back toward the central hall. How do we even know someone is in here?
Another complained. If they looked up. But they continued on, conversation fading. Nina took one last glance out the window. No mourners, she whispered, and launched herself through the broken glass. She fell fast and hit the ground hard. Her shoulder and hip screamed at the force of the impact, but Nina stifled any sound as she rolled down the slope, unable to stop her momentum. She tumbled into the tree line, struck the base of a pine, and forced herself to shove to her feet. She made herself take a moment to get oriented, then ran, dodging through the trees, keeping her hands up to try to stave off the slicing branches, trying to ignore the pain in her side. She had to get back to the convent and inside before the well mother returned. If she didn't, Leonie and Adric would be taken unawares, and all their covers would be blown. She came to a stream and charged through, shoes squelching in the shallows, then plunged down the next hill. There, the convent. Its windows still dark, though she could see lanterns in the stables, the chapel yard, the dish of scrap she had left out for Trassel. Nina ran, lost her footing, righted herself, half falling now, trying to get down the mountain. When she reached the edge of the trees, she slowed, angling to the south so she could avoid the stables. She heard the sound of hoofbeats and peered along the road. She saw the wagon, the driver whipping his horses hard. The well mother was returning from the factory, and Nina knew they would be searching the rooms within minutes. Nina pulled off her muddy shoes, slid inside the kitchen, locked the door, and shoved the key beneath the flour tin. She hurried to her bedroom, already dragging her ruined clothes over her head.
What's going on?
Leonie asked groggily as Nina stumbled into the room and hurriedly shut the door behind her.
Nothing, whispered Nina. Pretend to be asleep. Why?
Nina heard doors slamming and voices in the convent entry. She yanked off her clothes, wiped her face and hands clean with the inside of her blouse, and stuffed the whole sodden mess into the trunk at the foot of her bed.
I was here all night.
Oh, Nina, groaned Leonie. Please tell me you were just getting a midnight snack.
Yes, said Nina, wiggling into a night rail. A very muddy one.
Nina threw herself under the covers just as the door sprang open and light from the hall flooded the room. Nina made a pretense of startling awake.
What is it?
Two spring maidens stormed inside, pinafores rustling. Nina could hear voices in the dormitories above them, the clatter of doors opening and girls being woken from their sleep.
At least we're not the only ones under suspicion, thought Nina. Maybe they think a student snuck out to visit a soldier in the factory barracks.
What's going on? Asked Leonie.
Be silent, snapped one of the spring maidens. She held up her lantern, casting her gaze around the room. Nina saw it in the same moment the spring maiden did, a smudge of mud on the floor near the base of her bed. The spring maiden handed her companion her lantern and threw open the trunk, rummaging inside. She pulled out the filthy pinafore and blouse.
Why do you have a novitiate's uniform?
The spring maiden demanded.
And why is it covered in mud?
I'm going to get the well mother.
There's no need.
The well mother stood in the doorway, round face stern, hands folded over the dark blue wool of her pinafore.
Explain yourself, Anka Yanderstadt.
Nina opened her mouth, but before she could say a word, Hanna appeared behind the well mother.
The clothes are mine.
What?
They're mine, repeated Hanna,
looking ashen and lost, her hair flowing in thick ruddy waves over her shoulders.
I went riding when I was not supposed to, and took a fall from my horse.
The well mother narrowed her eyes.
Why would you hide them here?
I knew my dirty clothes would be discovered in my room, so I planned to wash them myself.
And somehow the widow Yanderstadt didn't notice a heap of muddy clothing in her trunk.
Mila said she would hide them for me until I could see to them.
The well mother eyed the soiled pinafore.
The mud seems fresh.
I went riding only this morning. You'll see the clothes are my size, far too long for Mila. It is my fault, not hers.
Is this true?
The well mother asked Nina. Nina looked at Hanna.
Is it?
The well mother demanded. Nina nodded. The well mother huffed a frustrated breath.
Finish the search, she instructed the spring maidens. Hanna, I cannot begin to express my disappointment. I will have to write your father immediately.
I understand, well mother, Hanna said, her misery clear.
It was no performance. She had risked her future at the convent to save Nina.
And you, Anka Yanderstadt, said the well mother. Your role here is to instruct Hanna in the Zemini language, not to enable her disruptive behaviors. I will have to reconsider this whole arrangement.
Yes, well mother, said Nina contritely, and watched as the woman shuffled Hanna down the hallway, closing the door behind her. Leonie flopped back on the pillows.
Please tell me whatever you learned inside the factory was worth it.
Nina lay back, adrenaline still flooding her body.
It was worth it.
But she'd seen the look in Hanna's eyes as the well mother led her away. She was going to want answers. Nina thought of the punishment Hanna would take. What a letter home to her father might mean. She owed Hanna. Maybe her life. She most certainly owed her the truth.
Help us.
But there was no way Nina could give it to her. Chapter 19. Zoya. Zoya had thought they would be led to new rooms that would serve as their living quarters. Instead, Joris and Grigori departed, and with a wave of Elisaveta's hand, the table and chairs dropped into the floor. A moment later, new walls rose around them. The sand twisted and arched, forming three doorways around a central chamber, all of it the lifeless, sun-leached color of old bone. Zoya was not sure how much more of this she could stand. The world felt like it had been torn open.
I wish we could offer more comfortable accommodations, said Elisaveta. But this is a place of few comforts. Rest if you can.
Zoya's room looked like a bedchamber in a castle of old, pointed windows, heavy leather-backed chairs that sat before a vast fireplace, a huge canopied bed hung with velvet curtains, and yet there was no glass in the windows. There was no leather, no velvet. It was all that fine-grained sand, every item, every surface wrought in the same driftwood hue.
The fire that burned in the grate flickered blue, like that horrid dragon's flames. It was a phantom room. Zoya's hand went to her wrist. She needed to talk to Nikolai. She opened the door, though it was hard to even think of it as a door when it hadn't existed moments before. Nikolai stood in the archway of a chamber identical to hers.
"It's like looking at a sketch of something grand," he said, turning slowly to take in his new quarters.
He ran a hand over the gray sand mantle.
"Luxurious in its detail, but devoid of anything that would actually make you want to stay here."
"This is a mistake," said Zoya. Her head hurt, her heart hurt. She had to keep her fingers from wandering continuously to her wrist, but she needed to think clearly. There were larger things at stake than what she'd lost. There always were.
"Where's Yuri?" he asked.
"Probably genuflecting somewhere." "Nikolai, is this a bargain we want to make?"
"We came here for a cure, and now we've been offered one."
"You could die."
"A risk we've long been willing to take. In fact, I believe you offered to put a bullet in my head not so long ago."
"We have less than 3 weeks before the party in North Alta," she protested.
"Then I will have to master the monster in that time."
"You saw what they can do. What if we shatter the bounds of the Unsea and unleash them on Ravka? Are you willing to make that gamble?"
Nikolai ran his hands through his hair.
"I don't know."
"And yet you agreed to dance at the first asking like a boy at a country ball."
"I did."
And he didn't sound remotely sorry about it.
"We can't trust them.
We don't really even know who they are."
"I understand that. Just as you understand, that is the choice we must make. Why are you fighting it, Zoya?"
Zoya leaned her head against the edge of the window and looked out at the nothing beyond. Had the saints been staring at this same empty view for hundreds of years?
"If these are the saints," she said, "then who have we been praying to all this time?"
"Do you pray?"
Nikolai couldn't conceal his surprise.
"I did. When I was young. They never answered."
"We'll get you another."
"Another?"
It took her a moment to understand what he meant. Without realizing it, Zoya had let her hand return to the place where her amplifier had been. She forced herself to release her wrist.
"You can't get me another," she said, her voice thick with scorn.
"Good. Better than self-pity."
"It doesn't work that way. I've worn that cuff, those bones, since I was 13 years old."
"Zoya, I don't believe in miracles. I don't know who these saints really are. All I know is that they're the last hope we have."
She squeezed her eyes shut. Elisaveta could be as gracious as she liked. It didn't change the fact that they'd been abducted.
"We're prisoners here, Nikolai. We don't know what they might ask of us."
"The first thing will be to banish your pride."
Nikolai and Zoya jumped. Juris stood in the doorway. He was in human form, but the shape of the dragon seemed to linger over him.
"Come, Zoya Nozhelensky, little storm witch. It's time."
"For what?"
Zoya bit out, feeling anger ignite inside her. Familiar. Welcome. So much more useful than grief.
"For your first lesson,"
he said.
"The boy king isn't the only one with something to learn."
Zoya did not want to go with the dragon, but she made herself follow him down the twisting halls of the Mad Palace. She told herself she'd be able to learn more about the ritual Nikolai was expected to endure and determine the saint's true motives. The stronger voice inside her said that if she got to know Juris, she could find a way to punish him for what he'd taken from her. She was too aware of her pulse beating beneath the skin of her bare wrist. It felt naked, vulnerable, and utterly wrong. Still, as much as she would have liked to give her thoughts over to revenge, the path they were taking required all her attention. The palace was vast, and though some individual rooms seemed to have specific characteristics, most of the hallways, stairs, and passages were wrought of the same glittering, colorless sand. It didn't help that no matter where you were inside the massive structure, you always had the same view. a wide gray expanse of nothing.
I can feel your anger, Storm Witch,
Joris said.
It makes the air crackle.
That word is offensive, she said to his back, soothed by the thought of shoving him down the long flight of stairs.
I can call you whatever you like. In my time, witch was the word men used for women they should steer clear of. I think that describes you very well.
Then perhaps you should take your own advice and avoid me.
I think not, said Joris. One of the only joys left to me is courting danger, and the fold offers few opportunities for it.
Would he even tumble if she pushed him, or just sprout wings and float gently to the bottom of the stairway? How old are you, anyway?
I've long since forgotten.
Joris looked to be a man of about 40. He was as big as Tolia, maybe larger, and Zoya could imagine he must have cut a daunting figure with a broadsword in his hand. She could see a tracery of scales over his shaven scalp, as if his dragon features had crept into his human body. Her curiosity got the better of her. Do you prefer your human form?
I have no preference. I am both human and dragon always. When I wish to read, to argue, to drink wine, I take the form of a man. When I wish to fly and be free of human bother, I am a dragon.
And when you fight? He glanced over his shoulder and his eyes flashed to silver, the pupils slitting as he smiled, his teeth slightly too long and predatory for his human mouth.
I could best you in either form.
I doubt that, she said with more confidence than she felt. If she'd still had her amplifier, there would have been no hesitation.
Do not forget I was a warrior in my first life.
Zoya raised an unimpressed brow. Sankt Joris, who slew the dragon, was really a Grisha who made it his amplifier. She knew the story well, every Ravkan child did. The warrior who had gone to best a beast and fought it 3 times before finally vanquishing it. But now she had to wonder how much was legend and how much was fact. Joris scowled and continued down the stairs.
Amplifier. Like that pathetic bauble you clung to so desperately. When I slew the dragon, I took his form and he took mine. We became one. In the old times, that's how it was. What you practice now is a corruption, the weakest form of the making at the heart of the world.
In the old times. Was there truth then in the stories of the Burning Thorn? Had those monks not been ordinary men, but Grisha, who had taken the shapes of beasts to better wage war against Ravka's enemies? Had both the Grisha theorists and the religious scholars gotten it so wrong? Zoya didn't know. Her tired, battered mind couldn't make sense of it. They entered an enormous chamber that looked at once like a cavern and the great hall of an ancient castle keep, wrought in black stone. A crest hung on one high wall, above a fireplace tall enough for Zoya to stand in. The crest showed 3 6-pointed stars, and was of the type Kalish families used, though Zoya did not know their iconography well enough to identify which name Joris might have once claimed. One wall had been left entirely open to the elements, the wide horizon of dead sand visible beyond. The jagged overhang made Zoya feel a bit like she was looking out at the world through the opening of a cave, or the mouth of a beast whose belly she had made the mistake of wandering into. "What is it you want from me?" she asked.
"When I pass into the mortal world, my magic will go with me. But my knowledge need not. You will carry it."
"What an honor," she said, without enthusiasm.
"All of the rules the Grisha have created, that you live by, the colors you wear. You think you've been training to make yourself stronger when really you've been training to limit your power."
Zoya shook her head. First, this oversized lizard had robbed her of the amplifier she'd earned with her own blood, and now he was insulting the training she'd dedicated her life to. She'd taken her education at the Little Palace seriously. The theories she'd read in the library, the poses and techniques she'd learned in Bagra's hut by the lake. She'd practiced and honed her abilities, forged her raw talent into something more. There had been other Ethereal'kai who had started with more natural ability, but none had worked as hard.
You can say that. But I know that training made me a better squaller.
Yes. But did it make you a better Grisha?
Isn't that what I just said?
Not quite. But I began in ignorance as deep as yours, and just like you, with nothing but the wild wind at my fingertips.
You were a squaller? Zoya asked, surprised.
There was no name for what I was.
But you could summon, she pushed.
I could. I did. It was one more weapon in my arsenal.
In what war?
In countless wars. I was hero to some. Others would have called me an invader. A barbarian. A sacker of temples. I tried to be a good man. At least that's what I remember.
How men like to recount their deeds.
Not all of us take to nobility as well as your king.
Zoya strolled the perimeter of the room. There was little to look at. Other than the weapons collected on the wall, everything was blackstone. The mantle of the great fireplace, where blue flame leapt and danced. The decorations atop it. The crest upon the wall.
If you expect me to damn Nikolai for his goodness, you'll have to wait a while.
And if I tell you Ravka needs a more ruthless ruler?
I'd say that sounds like the excuse of a ruthless man.
Who said anything about men?
Was that this creature's game? You wish me to steal my king's throne?
You mistake my ambitions.
Juris rumbled a laugh.
I mistake nothing. Do you really believe you were meant to spend your life in service? You cannot tell me you have not contemplated what it would mean to be a queen.
Zoya picked up a tiny agate horse on the mantle, one of a herd of what might be hundreds that flowed over the stone. Was this how Juris spent his eternity, using fire to fashion tiny reminders of another life?
As if a queen does not live her life in service too.
I serve the Grisha. I serve Ravka.
Ravka.
He rolled the R in a growl.
You serve a nation of ghosts. All those you failed, all those you will continue to fail until you become what you were meant to be.
All those you failed? What did he know about anything? Zoya set down the horse and rubbed her arms. She didn't like the way the dragon talked. His words rattled around inside her, made her think of that falling stone. That empty well, that endless hollow. Do not look back, Liliana had warned her once. Do not look back at me. Zoya hadn't listened then, but she'd learned to heed those words.
Finish your story, old man, or set me free to go find a glass of wine and a nap.
You'll find no wine here, little witch. No sleep either. No respite from oblivion.
Zoya gave a dismissive wave.
Then set me free to find more interesting company.
Juris shrugged.
There is little more to tell. A ravaging beast came to our land, burning everything in its path, devouring all those who dared oppose it.
Idly, Zoya touched her finger to the ball of a mace on the wall. Juris must have had the weapons with him when they were trapped on the fold.
I always thought the dragon was a metaphor.
Juris looked almost affronted.
For what?
Heathen religion, foreign invaders,
the perils of the modern world.
Sometimes a dragon is just a dragon, Zoya Nozylensky. And I can assure you no metaphor has ever murdered so many.
You've never heard Tolia recite poetry. So, the great warrior went to meet the dragon in his lair?
Just so. Can you imagine my terror?
I have an inkling.
She would never forget the first sight of Joris, with his vast wings spread, and she wanted to know how he'd bested the beast.
What did you do?
What all frightened men do. The night before I was to meet the dragon, I went down on my knees and prayed.
Who does the saint pray to?
I never claimed to be a saint, Zoya. That is just the name a desperate world gave me. That night, I was nothing more than a scared man. A boy, really, barely 18. I prayed to the god of the sky, who had watched over my family. The god of storms, who had watered the fields and fed on careless sailors. Maybe it is that god who watches over me still. All I know is something answered. When I faced the dragon and he breathed fire, the winds rose to my command. I was able to snatch his breath away, just as you tried to do with me. Twice we clashed, and twice we retreated to see to our wounds. But on the third meeting, I dealt him a fatal blow.
Joris in triumph.
She would not do him the courtesy of sounding impressed, but he surprised her by saying,
"Perhaps I should have felt triumphant. It's what I expected. But when the dragon fell, I knew nothing but regret."
"Why?" she asked, though she had always felt sorry for the dragon in Joris' story, a beast who could not help his nature. Joris leaned his big body against the basalt wall.
"The dragon was the first true challenge I'd ever known as a warrior, the only creature able to meet me as an equal in the field. I could not help but respect him. As he sank his jaws into me, I knew he felt just as I did. The dragon and I were the same, connected to the heart of creation, born of the elements and unlike any other."
"Like calls to like," she said softly.
She knew that feeling of kinship, of ferocity. If she closed her eyes, she would feel the ice on her cheeks, see the blood in the snow.
"But in the end, you killed him."
"We both died that day, Zoya. I have his memories and he has mine. We have lived a thousand lives together. It was the same with Grigori and the Great Bear. With Elisaveta and her bees, have you never stopped to wonder how it's possible that some Grisha are themselves amplifiers?"
Zoya hadn't really. Grisha who were born amplifiers were rare and often served as examiners, using their abilities to test for the presence of Grisha power in children. The Darkling himself had been an amplifier, as had his mother. It was one of the theories for why he had been so powerful. "No," she admitted.
"They are connected to the making at the heart of the world. In the time before the word Grisha had ever been spoken, the lines that divided us from other creatures were less firm. We did not just take an animal's life. We gave up a part of ourselves in return. But somewhere along the way, Grisha began killing. Claiming a piece of the power of creation without giving anything of ourselves. This is the pathetic tradition of your amplifiers."
"Should I feel shame for claiming an amplifier?" Zoya said.
He had no right to these judgments. How often had Zoya cried? How many futile prayers had she spoken, unable to rid herself of that stubborn, stupid belief that someone would answer?
"It must be easy to ponder the universe, safe in your palace, away from the petty, brutal dealings of man. Maybe you don't remember what it was to be powerless. I do."
"Maybe so,"
said Joris.
"But you still wept for the tiger."
Zoya froze. He couldn't know. No one knew what she had done that night, what she had seen. "What do you mean?"
"When you are tied to all things, there is no limit to what you may know. The moment that bracelet dropped from your wrist, I saw it all. Young Zoya bleeding in the snow, a heart full of valor. Zoya of the Lost City, Zoya of the Garden. You could not protect them then, and you cannot protect them now. Not you and not your monster king."
"Do not look back at me. The well within her had no bottom. She tossed a stone into the darkness, and she fell with it on and on. She needed to get out of this room, to get away from Juris. Are we done here?
We haven't yet begun. Tell me, Storm Witch, when you slew the tiger, did you not feel its spirit moving through you? Feel it take the shape of your anger?
Zoya did not want to speak of that night. The dragon knew things he could not know. She forced herself to laugh. You're saying I might have become a tiger?
Maybe. But you are weak, so who can be certain?
Zoya curled her lip. She kept herself still, though the rage inside her leapt. Do you mean to goad me? It will take more than the slights of an old man.
You showed courage when we fought. Ingenuity. Nerve. And still you lost. You will continue to lose until you open the door.
He turned suddenly and lunged toward her, his body growing larger, blotting out the light as his wings spread. His vast jaws parted and the flame bloomed from somewhere inside him. Zoya threw her arms over her head, cowering. Abruptly, the flames banked and Juris stood looking at her in his human form.
Have I chosen a weakling?
He said in disgust. But now it was Zoya's turn to smile. Or maybe just a girl who knows how to look like one. Zoya stood and thrust her hands forward. The storm thundered through him, a straight shot of wind and ire that knocked Juris from his feet and sent him tumbling, skating along the smooth stone floor, and right out of the cave mouth. Weak, a fraction of the strength she had commanded with her amplifier. But he rolled over the edge and vanished, the surprise on his face like a balm to Zoya's heart. A moment later, the dragon rose on giant wings.
Did I break your will when I broke your silly bauble?
Had he? Without her amplifier, summoning her power was like reaching for something and misjudging the distance, feeling your fingers close over nothing but air. She had always been powerful, but it was the tiger's life that had given her true strength. And now it was gone. What was she? Who was she without it? If they ever got free of this place, how was she supposed to return to her command?
Choose a weapon, said Juris.
I'm too tired for this.
Give me a worthy fight and you can go hide wherever you like. Choose a weapon.
I am the weapon. Or she had been. I don't need a cudgel or a blade.
Very well, said Juris,
shifting smoothly into his human form.
I'll choose one for you.
He grabbed a sword from the wall and tossed it to her. She caught it awkwardly with both hands. It was far too heavy, but she had no time to think. He was already springing toward her, a massive broadsword in his hands. What is the point of this? She asked, as he struck her blade with a blow that reverberated up her arms. I've never been any good at swordplay.
You've spent your life only choosing the paths at which you knew you could excel. It's made you lazy.
Zoya grimaced and parried, trying to remember her long-ago education with Botkin Yulordine. They'd used knives and rapiers, and even taken target practice with pistols. Zoya had enjoyed all of it, particularly the hand-to-hand combat, but she'd had little cause to practice her skills since. What was the point of using her fists when she could command a storm?
Not bad,
he said, as she succeeded in dodging one of his thrusts.
Using your power has become too easy for you. When you fight this way, you have to focus so entirely on surviving that you stop thinking about everything else. You cannot worry about what came before or what happens next, what has been lost or what you might gain. There is only this moment.
What possible advantage is that? Zoya said. Isn't it better to be able to predict what comes next?
When your mind is free, the door opens.
What door?
The door to the making at the heart of the world.
Zoya fainted right and stepped close to deny Juris the advantage of his longer reach. That is already what I do when I summon, she said, sweat beginning to drip from her brow. That is what all Grisha do when we use our power.
Is it?
He asked, bringing his sword down again. The clash of metal filled her ears.
The storm is still outside you. Something you welcome and guard against all at once. It howls inside the door, it rattles the windows, it wants to be let in.
That makes no sense.
Let the storm in, Zoya. Do not summon, do not reach for it. Let it come to you. Let it guide your movements. Give me a proper fight.
Zoya